which would protect the human rights of farm workers in the fields. This program has radically transformed the industry. It is also now expanding. We're not just talking about Florida anymore. We're now talking about bell peppers and strawberries. We're talking about six other states on the East Coast. And it has the potential to just grow even more than that. And so Wendy's is choosing to not be part of the solution.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. And of course, we'll continue to follow this struggle. Natalie Rodriguez, member of the Alliance for Fair Food. Many thanks to the students here at OTV. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 4:59. Stay tuned for the KBOO Tuesday evening news. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, from our hands to yours, celebrating 43 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods and with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification, a public lecture by Jeff Halper, Tuesday, February 23rd at 7 p.m. at the First United Methodist Church in Portland. Jeff Halper is the longtime head of the Israel Committee Against House Demolitions and is known for his activism on the ground in support of Palestinian rights and a just peace. Jeff will be on a book tour for his recently published book, War Against the People. Again, that's War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification, a public lecture by Jeff Halper, Tuesday, February 23rd at 7 p.m. at the First United Methodist Church, 1838 Southwest Jefferson in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 26th annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 5th through March 5th. Most of the films will screen at Portland Community College Cascade Campus, and two films will show at the Hollywood Theater. The five-week-long festival of feature and documentary films come from all over the African continent and include Thursday evening documentary screenings, Family Film Day, and Women Filmmakers Week, held during the first week of March in celebration of Women's History Month. Again, that's 26th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, playing Thursday through Saturday until March 5th. Most of the films will screen at Portland Community College Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street, in the Arts and Humanities Building in Room 104. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon Legislature has their final meeting on marijuana legalization for 2016.
President Obama submitted a plan to Congress that outlines an imperative to close the detention facility at Guantanamo.
And we have a live interview with artist Ilima Considine about misogyny in the music industry. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 23rd, 2016. I'm Kanan.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. Three Oregon lawmakers have asked the CDC for assistance with Portland's ongoing toxic air crisis. Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley and U.S. Representative Earl Blumenauer sent a letter to the Center for Disease Control yesterday requesting assistance from federal authorities. They are hoping to get the CDC and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry to help local authorities in screening residents for heavy metal exposure, soil testing, and other health needs brought on by the pollution. The letter was sent after residents began expressing concern over heavy metal exposure in their neighborhoods from nearby glass factories. Free urine tests are being offered to concerned residents. State officials say that those living within a half a mile of the factories are at most risk. Any residents found to have cadmium in their system will be investigated. Soil near the factories is currently being tested for heavy metals by environmental authorities.
Today marked the final meeting of the legislature's Joint Committee on Marijuana Legalization for 2016. A number of changes were made to the state's marijuana programs this session. One bill is already awaiting the governor's signature, a second is likely to land on her desk soon, and two more were passed out of committee this afternoon. A number of major changes to both the medical and the adult use marijuana programs are being enacted this session. To learn more about this legislature's plans for Oregon's marijuana industry, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Anthony Taylor, a veteran marijuana reform activist.
Could you talk us through some of the most significant changes the legislature is making this session regarding the medical marijuana program?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is that they're exempting patients from paying any taxes on their medicine. I think that's a very important thing to have happen. And a couple other things is the exemption from land use compatibility statements for the medical marijuana growers. Yeah, so those are two very important things. We've also, this session, reestablished a relationship between patients and processors. So patients can get their product processed and get it back from a processor rather than having to go to a dispensary to get it back. So there's important things that are going on for patients. However, we still, while they remove residency requirements for most of the business licenses, you still have to be a resident in Oregon to be a patient. Now, it doesn't take much, but it's still a requirement, and we find it odd that the state won't grant an out-of-state patient a card in fear that they'll take marijuana home to their home state with them, while at the same time allowing retail sales to non-residents who also take product home with them.
In the meeting today, one of the bills that passed actually had some several amendments offered, which were defeated. The residency requirement was one. There was also another concern over the fees that the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program has accumulated. Could you talk us through that one?
Well, fees have always been an issue, and one of the biggest issues about fees is the lack of transparency in raising them and allocating them. And while we support reduction of fees to be commensurate with the administration of the program, there is a certain sentiment out there about leaving the fees alone for two reasons. One is only 56% of all patients pay the $200 fee. And the other is if we had that transparency, these patients would be more than happy to keep paying that fee, because the money would be used to help patients in the program and or dedicated to research funding. If we had those, we'd be good. But, you know, we do support getting those fees down. But with that in mind, it sure would be nice to, you know, see fees that are generated going to improve the program and allowing for research funding.
In fact, one of the members of the committee made the point that taxes are how the revenue gets raised, and that fees are basically to operate a program. Using a fee system as a cash cow seemed to go against the but that amendment failed.
Well, it's a complicated issue, and you know. I know that Representative Buckley supported it, citing the fact that, you know, they have time coming up at the 2017 session to get a handle on this and restructure it so it goes right in Ways and Means.
Two major bills the committee have passed so far this session. One's awaiting the governor's signature. The other cleared the Senate and although ran into a little opposition, and then is expected to clear the House and go to the governor. In addition to the medical, we're changing the adult use program. It hasn't even rolled out. When it finally does, what can we expect to see?
Well, I think we're going to see most of the OHA dispensaries roll into licensed OLCC outlets. And I think that we're going to see a good deal of revenue generated from all these moves. And unfortunately, it's going to limit the ability of the medical marijuana growers with excess to be able to get that into a regulated supply system, because the OLCC won't allow any product into their system that isn't seed-to-sale tracked. So even though the OHA will be tracking and growers will be reporting, it doesn't meet the bar for the OLCC, so it's going to be problematic.
The question of whether the medical program will get rolled into the adult use program, it's been a constant concern. And any thoughts on whether that actually will end up happening?
Well, I think they're two different animals, frankly, and I think that very fact will keep them from being merged completely. There really is no reason that the OHA should be spending time developing a program for processors or their actual reporting. There's no reason that that shouldn't all be consolidated. But the needs of the medical marijuana patients for concentration dosages and confidentiality cannot afford to be rolled into the commerce model. And so that's what we're going to fight to maintain, is this spirit of confidentiality in treating patients like patients of any other medical condition category. There's no reason that they can't be treated the same way in obtaining their products and treating their conditions as people with diabetes using insulin or any other number of patient maladies out there. Get medication for those specific ailments.
Well, I've been speaking with Anthony Taylor. He is the president and co-founder of Compassionate Oregon and a longtime lobbyist and activist in marijuana reform in Oregon. Anthony, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
New data in the British Journal of Nutrition shows most studies have concluded that organic meat has more essential nutrients than meat from conventional sources like feedlots. Not all of Oregon's grass-fed cattle meat is designed organic, but grass-feeding is perhaps the most essential factor for producing meat high in nutrients. Comment by Carlo Leifert, professor of ecological agriculture at Newcastle University, and Joe Pastana, rancher with Oregon Grass-Fed, are as follows.
Researchers' analysis of a bulk of studies from around the world finds organic production of dairy and meat delivers more nutrients to diners. The recent study published in the British Journal of Nutrition shows organic meat and dairy contains 50% more omega-3 fatty acids, which contains nutrients linked to lower risks of cardiovascular disease and improved mental health. Co-author of the study, Carlo Leifert, explains how organic and conventional foods differ.
I think the main difference with respect to the composition differences we've seen is the feeding regimes. The organic standards, they enforce outside grazing and access to the outside, and they restrict, especially for ruminants, concentrate feeds.
Leifert adds, the study did not conclude that organic foods were healthier, only that most studies showed an increased level of nutrients. Oregon is plentiful with grassy valleys ideal for grazing. Although the cattle raised on his ranch can't be considered organic because of a dewormer chemical used on his land, Joe Pastanu of Langlois, Oregon, uses organic grazing standards. Pastanu says grass-fed cattle need more acreage than feedlot cattle, but Oregon has enough land to accommodate ranches like his.
The luxury of having small population size is that you can have places like this and have a healthy product.
Along with the need for land, another downside to grass-fed cattle is that the meat is often more expensive. For KBOO News, I'm Demi Hellenius.
The hip-hop artist Kesha's court case against the Sony Corporation mixed music, rape, and high finance. A judge ruled yesterday that the fact the artist may have been raped by her former manager is not enough to break her contract with Sony, even though it was the alleged rapist who directed her to sign the contract. Kesha brought suit against her former manager, Lucas Gottwald, in civil court, alleging that the rape, which she said came days after she turned 18, means she is barred from making music with anyone other than her alleged rapist unless and until a 7-album contract with Sony is completed. Is that normal? Or is it just something that happens to famous people? Here to talk about misogyny in hip hop is Alima Considine, a musician, artist, and businesswoman whose show The Sex Bots combines music with multimedia performance. Alima, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
First, tell us about your work. Where did your show come from?
It came from a desire to depict women's emotions and sexuality as I saw to be realistic and not the way it is depicted in pop culture, which I feel is full of damaging and untrue tropes about how love and sex work. And people who are raised listening to this and repeating it as if it were a spell are less equipped to deal with their relationships and their sexuality.
And Alima, what's the difference for our listeners between misogyny and basic sexism, and what do they both look like for you and as you work through your career?
Well, if you look at dictionary definitions of those words, they're very similar, but I think in the way that we are using them in the discussion, misogyny is hatred towards women on a basic level, often a subliminal level, for both men and women. And sexism is the practices brought about because of that belief. Sorry, what was the second question?
How do these come into play as you work in your career? Do you encounter them on a daily basis,
yes.
Regularly?
Yes.
In what sort of form?
Every point of the show, basically, it is generally encountered on some level. One of the things that I have been spreading around over the past year are pins that say, "I'm not with the band," which is based on all the times at music festivals and at shows, even here in Portland, where I've had to fight for my wristband on the basis that staff don't believe that women are musicians, that they're just girlfriends there to give the drummer a ride. And for all the times that I've had to say, "I'm not with the band, I am the band," which is even a struggle at fairly large festivals, even ones that I'm headlining sometimes.
So what are the issues around sexism, specifically in the hip-hop music world? And are they unique, or is that just the way they're reported in major mainstream media?
Well, I mean, there are certain traditions in hip-hop lyrics. Without going into the whole bad man tradition, which is basically I'm a bigger, badder, richer guy than you, and my woman is bigger and badder than you too, and all that. It's a scene where I have recently encountered things that I am not willing to play nice with anymore. I was assaulted at a show on New Year's Eve, and I have been part of the response to a local rapper raping someone in the last month. And the pushback has been really intense. So much so that I've been warned that I was going to get jumped at shows. And
wow.
It's led to some really difficult and painful conversations because victim blaming, I think it's not necessarily a hip-hop thing, it's often a class thing, but the whole virgin whore dichotomy that someone's either a nice girl that we take care of or someone's not and we don't, which I find unacceptable, and I don't think a woman appearing in public is... makes it acceptable to assault her, or a woman appearing in public while attractive is an excuse either. But there are particular responses that I have found at hip-hop shows, which to me are more striking because it's not my scene. I do work with hip-hop producers. I do hooks for rappers. I have rappers guest on my songs, but I don't make hip-hop music, and I am not of that culture. So to me, everything is strange and new and shocking because I don't have the assumptions of someone who's raised in it. And there is what I've been calling publicly, and maybe it's a term that I'm not using correctly because I feel like I made it up, homie culture, which is a guy does something to you, and then when you seek help, all his friends say, it's okay, he's the homie. Or, it's okay, he's the homie and he was probably drunk. Or, he's the homie and you are mistaken. All these things, like, it's very formulaic. And when I started talking about this publicly, women started reaching out to me because they have been told these exact same things over and over to the extent that they cannot ask for assistance from the men in their lives because they already know what they're going to hear. And so this is a scene where women are, I feel, more unsafe. And I've played shows in all kinds of genres. I've played crazy burner parties, kink festivals, indie music things, and hip-hop shows are where I feel women are most unsafe. And if you look at the crowds, it's reflected in that too. They're mostly male, and most of the girls in the audience at local hip-hop shows are girlfriends of someone on stage. That's because people don't feel safe at those shows. And when I was assaulted in front of witnesses, I was told, it's okay, he's the homie. But if it happened, he was probably drunk. And if it happened, you were mistaken. I was told to my face that my narrative was less acceptable than my assaulter's.
So it seems like we're running a little bit short on time, but I want to ask one more quick question. Can you, for our listeners, talk about sex positive, the term, and how that might be a way to combat this type of prevailing behavior?
Well, it's not a term that I'm especially fond of because it is often used for extreme acts like peaches, like very explicit, like over the top, so far beyond the bounds of taste that it's like a anyway, but what I feel that term should mean is sex realism, is that sex itself is not inherently shameful, and sex for pleasure isn't inherently shameful, and something that we don't all realize as children, but eventually realize is everyone has a crotch. And, you know, like, it's actually a normal part of life to have biological sexual functions. Like, that's not, like, something rare or strange or shameful. Well, it's actually normal.
Yeah. Alima, we're just about out of time, but can you quickly shout out the next time you're performing?
I will be performing at the album release party for my new album, The Girlfriend Experience, April 24th at Dante's. It's an early show with doors at 8 and show at 9.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Alima.
You're welcome.
That was Alima Considine of the Sexbots speaking on misogyny in the music industry. You can find her work at www.ilimaconsidine.com.
The issue of lead contaminating public water has become a public health crisis for many cities in America. One city managed to stay ahead of the game, and now other cities are looking to it as an example for how to move forward. For more, we go to Rebecca Williams with the Environment Report.
Flint looks to Lansing for lessons in lead line replacement. This is the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams. Flint's mayor, Karen Weaver, says she doesn't want to waste any time getting rid of the city's old lead service lines. It's those lines, which bring water from the main to your house, that have caused so much trouble in Flint. The city did not treat the water from the Flint River properly. That meant it ate away at those pipes and contaminated the water in many homes with lead. Lansing launched one of the nation's most ambitious lead line replacement programs about a dozen years ago. Sarah Hewlett reports that city has some lessons for Flint.
Since it started the work in 2004, Lansing has taken out more than 13,000 lead service lines.
When we used to do this, we started out, you would take a backhoe and dig a hole in the center of the road or where the water main is, and then trench all the way to the customer's basement.
That's Dick Pethling. He's the general manager of the Lansing Board of Water and Light.
So, you know, it was a lot of work, and there was a lot of restoration because you had to go through the sidewalk and the curb and some of the landscaping. And so early on, we decided that that was going to be very expensive and a slow process. It took about 8 to 9 hours to do one house.
So they retooled their process. Puffley stands outside a house on the east side of the city where a jackhammer is punching a hole in the street. They'll also dig a hole where the shutoff valve is. Then they'll go into the house, take out the water meter, and snake a cable through the old lead line.
And then a backhoe out here grabs that cable and pulls it backwards. And as it does that, it's pulling the lead service out under the ground and a new copper service in. And then we just have to hook it up to the water main and put a water meter back in. So it's that simple. Takes, on a good day, 4 hours. Today probably isn't a good day. 16 degrees out.
Lansing's approach helped it cut the time and the cost of replacing those lines by at least half. And that's important for Flint. City officials think they'll need to replace about 15,000 lines, and they want to do it in a year. And that is where Lansing and Flint are very different.
We had the luxury of time. In Flint, they don't have the luxury of time.
That's Lansing Mayor Virge Brunero.
They have a crisis. They have a real crisis, and they have a crisis in confidence. And the crisis in confidence leads to a continued crisis in the economy. It's as though a neutron bomb went off in Flint.
Lansing could take its time replacing lead lines because the water was otherwise pretty safe. That's not the case in Flint. So last week, the mayor there, Karen Weaver, announced a plan called Fast Start. She wants to get started immediately. But there's a lot that's unknown about Flint's lead service lines, and they're not minor details. The city doesn't really know how many there are or where they are. An infrastructure study is expected to get underway soon to figure those things out. But in the meantime, Weaver says they'll start work on high-risk households first. That includes homes with kids under six, children with elevated lead levels, and pregnant women.
And we have enough money to go ahead and get started with that. We're waiting for some more, but we won't wait on that.
Governor Snyder has asked the legislature to approve $25 million for lead service line replacement. Weaver says the city needs more than twice that to do the work. In the meantime, experts say no one in Flint should drink unfiltered tap water, no matter what test results say about their lead levels. That's because the water system is so compromised, lead flakes could come out of people's taps basically anywhere, at any time. For the Environment Report, I'm Sarah Hewlett, Michigan Radio News.
Special thanks to Lindsay Scullin for her help reporting this story. That's the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams.
This past Saturday, presidential primaries were held in Nevada and South Carolina. In Nevada, Hillary Clinton beat Bernie Sanders after losing to him in New Hampshire's Democratic primary. Donald Trump won South Carolina with a huge lead over the second leading contender, Marco Rubio. Ted Cruz got almost as many votes as Rubio, coming in at number three. Jeb Bush, John Kasich, and Ben Carson came nearly 15 points behind the top three candidates. After a poor showing in the South Carolina primary, Jeb Bush suspended his campaign. Today, the Republicans will battle it out in Nevada, and on Saturday, the Democrats will have their primary in South Carolina.
To the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Noreen Shaw from Amnesty International. This will be followed by This Way Out at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. News and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is cloudy with a high of 61. Tomorrow evening's low is 41. Today in history, in 1927, President Calvin Coolidge signed the bill that established the Federal Radio Commission, which would later become the Federal Communications Commission. The quote of the day is from Frederick Douglass, who said, "To suppress free speech is a double wrong. It violates the rights of the hearer as well as those of the speaker."
It's 5:29. Time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
By gollies, Congress wants answers. Who's responsible for the shocking scandal of lead-poisoned drinking water in Flint, Michigan, the lawmakers screech? Every official involved in so callously disregarding the lives of the families in this poverty-stricken African-American city certainly deserves public shaming. But if the congressional inquisitors really want to find the culprit ultimately responsible for poisoning Flint, they should look in the nearest mirror. For 30 years, right-wing Republicans have pushed their destructive ideology of budget-slashing austerity on every level of America's government. One result of their pious anti-public spending fervor is that they've recklessly ignored upkeep of our nation's vast network of underground pipes that are supposed to bring clean, safe water into our homes. Even though Congress banned the use of lead pipes for water systems back in 1986, subsequent Congresses failed to budget for properly treating or replacing the old ones. So families across America, not just in Flint, face the real possibility of lead leaching into their water. How many families? No one knows. Some experts estimate that there are 10 million miles of lead pipes still in use, potentially turning people's tap water into a major, undetected health hazard. Playing ideological politics with our infrastructure is stupid and costly in more ways than money. Yet, while congressional Republicans are blaming EPA for the failures in Flint, they're the ones who've been cutting the agency's drinking water budget and staff for years, even clamoring to abolish the EPA altogether, apparently trusting the tooth fairy to keep poisons out of our water. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's time for these political extremists to stop playing political games, shut up, and start putting up the money necessary to make America's infrastructure world-class.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A first-of-a-kind grocery store has opened in Denmark in an effort to combat food waste. WeFood sells food and other consumer goods that are still legal to sell, but which might normally be thrown out because of damaged packaging, improper labeling, or because it is close to its expiration date. The store receives donated goods and has agreements with butchers and importers of produce, as well as with the largest supermarket chain in Denmark. WeFood claims that it will sell these goods at prices 30 to 50% lower than the average grocery store. Volunteers make up the bulk of the workforce for the store, and profits generated go to Dan Church Aid, a nonprofit that focuses on helping the world's poorest populations. WeFood is attempting to reduce the 700,000 tons of food waste that Denmark produces every year. This is the latest effort for Denmark, a country which has already reduced the food waste it produces by 25%.
Over 100,000 refugees have arrived in Greece since the beginning of 2016, three times the rate of last year. Many of the countries the refugees have been traveling through have begun to close their borders. On Friday, Austria restricted the number of people it would allow into the country to 8 asylum seekers, and the number of people traveling through Austria to other EU countries is being limited to 3,200. In a domino effect, this move prompted other countries to tighten their borders as well, creating a bottleneck and sparking riots at the Greece-Macedonia border. Greek police are supervising buses to transport refugees away from the border to army-built camps in Athens. Doctors Without Borders has condemned Europe's chaotic response to the migrant crisis, claiming that migrants are stranded at the border with no information on border restrictions, little to no humanitarian aid, and a pervasive risk of violence and abuse. While a temporary truce is being organized between Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad and Syrian revolutionary forces, the exclusion of ISIS causes many to doubt the success of a ceasefire. With continued fighting in the region and improving weather in the spring, the influx of migrants is expected to continue.
At least 29 people are reported dead and 4 are missing after Cyclone Winston swept over the island nation of Fiji this weekend. Reports of widespread damage are still coming in from more remote parts of the country. 8 bodies were found on the island of Koro, which bore the brunt of the Category 5 cyclone. 4 others are believed to be lost at sea. The Fijian government has declared a 30-day state of emergency. It's estimated that half of the island's population of 900,000 was directly affected by the strong winds and rain. The storm had wind gusts of 90 miles per hour and brought waves up to 40 feet high. As aid agencies hurry to Providence assistance, at least 8,000 people are in evacuation centers amid concerns about waterborne disease. Australia has sent humanitarian and medical aid as well.
A teaching aide for the Oregon City School District has been arrested after being accused of sexually abusing a student and possessing child pornography. James McLaughlin was arrested over the weekend by federal authorities on suspicion of production of child pornography. Investigators say that they found child pornography on McLaughlin's computer, as well as essays where he allegedly detailed plans to drug and abuse children. McLaughlin is a teaching aide for the developmentally disabled children. According to authorities, McLaughlin allegedly confessed to the grandmother of one of the victims of his, quote, inappropriate behavior in owning child pornography. Oregon City School District Superintendent Larry Didway said that the district is cooperating with authorities in their investigation. McLaughlin has been suspended from his position with the Oregon City School District. The Clackamas County Sheriff is seeking other potential victims. If you have any information regarding the case, you can reach the Clackamas County Sheriff at 503-723-4949.
And now, a commentary from Community Rights by Paul Cienfuegos.
Greetings. You're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Anyone who lives in Portland, Oregon today knows that our city is in crisis in numerous ways. Renters are being tossed out of their homes in large numbers using a perfectly legal but highly unethical method known as a no-cause eviction, simply so that landlords can make a few upgrades to their homes or apartments and then jack up the monthly rent as much as 60% per month in order to then turn around and rent to the flood of people pouring in from much more expensive cities who are used to paying much higher rents than what Portlanders can afford. I personally know many longtime residents who will likely have to leave Portland in the near future because they've been priced out of their homes. People of color have been the hardest hit, so America's whitest major city is about to become even whiter. Many locally owned businesses are also being thrown out of their buildings all over the city so that the owners of those buildings can bulldoze them and build four-story monstrosities in their place, again, all totally legal but highly unethical. Our local police continues to be out of control, either unable or unwilling to accept the reforms that citizens are demanding, so that people of color, especially, no longer need to fear that they will be the victims of police violence. I could carry on and on with this list. Our beloved Portland is in trouble, and those who live here know this to be true. We are at a moment in our city's history where it really matters a lot who our elected officials are going to be in the next few years. Are we going to continue with business as usual, where the 1% has enormous power over our local government? Or are we, the people of Portland, going to pay much closer attention to the candidates for mayor and city council in order to ensure that we get the best local leaders we possibly can? A battle is now brewing between a growing number of Portland voters and our corporate daily newspaper, The Oregonian, which causes me great concern. And in my opinion, if the voters don't win this round of the battle, our city could sink into even further crisis. I'm talking about the Oregonian's plan to host a major public debate next Monday, February 29, for the upcoming election for mayor. 12 candidates have filed to run. More than half of them have the potential to become outstanding mayors, in my opinion. And yet the Oregonian has invited only 2 of the 12 candidates to their mayoral debate next Monday, Ted Wheeler and Jules Bailey. Anyone who cares about democracy and the right of the people to participate in free and fair elections with no manipulation by corporate interests should be very concerned at this point, as the Oregonians' management has already decided that Portland voters should have just two corporation-approved candidates to choose from, not 12. In their public statement from February 9, the Oregonian wrote, quote, "We could have invited all of those who'd filed for office to this month's debate, but this would have involved a significant trade-off. The audience might come away knowing more about a handful of candidates with little chance to win and limited ability to serve effectively In exchange, though, they'd know less than they would otherwise about Wheeler and Bailey," unquote. And the Oregonian's editorial and commentary editor, Eric Lukens, stated, quote, "In our opinion, the qualification and relevant experience gap between these two and the rest of the field is wide enough to justify inviting only them," unquote. As you can imagine, there has been tremendous pushback from voters, yet the Oregonian has stated repeatedly that they will not be opening the debate to anybody else, not even to the only female candidate, Sarah Yanaron, who certainly has the competency and background to run a serious campaign. An increasing number of outraged voters believe that the Oregonian newspaper has a duty and a responsibility to serve the people of Portland. And a small group of these voters has organized an action alert demanding that the Oregonian open its debate to all registered voters or expect to have their event canceled nonviolently through mass civil disobedience. If you want to learn more about the efforts of this ad hoc group's campaign, check out their Facebook page titled, "Tell the Oregonian Stop Choosing Our Mayoral Candidates for Us." The Portland Mercury is already covering this story on its website, and I expect as voter anger continues to build between today and next Monday's so-called debate, there will be a lot more media coverage, which will generate an even larger number of angry voters. Again, if you want to know more about this unfolding story, you can go to Facebook and type in the following words, "Tell the Oregonian, stop choosing our mayoral candidates for us." I think it's critical at this moment of growing economic and ecological crises in our country that the citizenry stand up tall, draw a line in the sand, and insist that our elections are ours, that no corporation, including the giant media corporation that owns our daily newspaper, has the right to interfere in how we choose our elected officials. Bernie Sanders has already proven that the American electorate is tired of business as usual in this country, and that the public is ready and able to mobilize itself to take back our country from large corporations and the 1%. Is it conceivable that voters here in Portland will also rise up in the next 6 days to remind the Oregonians' management that they have a duty to fulfill here in Portland, and that anything less than a full about-face from the Oregonian will result in the cancellation of this phony corporate-sponsored debate through nonviolent direct action by Portland voters? It's going to be an exciting week. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly commentary via iTunes or communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my community rights updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kanan Schlesinger, Dominic Anaya, Jenna Yokoyama, Demi Hellenius, Jeff Henderson, and Kurt Bender. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. Or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to the KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Paul Roland welcomes members of BARC to talk about stopping new timber sales on Mount Hood and forest protection, past and present. At 9, we celebrate Fisher Poets with Mo Baustern, Fisher Poet and Perry Broderick, the son of one of the founders of the Fisher Poets Gathering in Astoria. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, here Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on The Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter asks a panel of guests from local climate groups, what does it take to motivate us to bridge the gap between knowing and acting? And how do we participate in restructuring our world? Thank you, KBOO members, for your continuing support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Today.
And stay tuned now for news in depth on closing Guantanamo.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today, President Obama submitted a plan to Congress that outlines an imperative to close the detention facility at Guantanamo, where 91 detainees are still held.